Hi, once again, welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Always one of my favorite days of the month. It's the time for the Science Forum. We've gathered our panel of science experts to respond to your questions and comments. The number to call, what, are you, is somebody laughing? No, you're experts, right? The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us. VoxPop@WAMC.org. You can tweet at WAMC Vox Pop. You can go to our website, WAMC.org/VoxPop. There's a spot you can comment there. Anything else? Oh, Facebook, right? WAMC Radio. There'll be a Facebook post for Vox Pop. Let's see. But the number, I mean, it's a call-in show. So call 1-800-348-2551. With all that said, let's meet our panel of brilliant people.
Helmut Hirsch, Professor Emeritus, the University at Albany, biology, psychology, and a little bit of anthropology.
Well, all right.
Oh. I'm Nancy Slack, ecologist from the Sage Colleges.
Helen Girardella, Department of Biology, the University at Albany, biology, some anthropology, and a little bit of photonics.
All right. Well, you'll answer questions on general science as well, all of you, yes?
We all do the best we can.
You give it a shot. Right. Now, Nancy, you just got back from an emergency trip.
Well, I think some of you know I've been working on Mount Washington with several others on a project related to future climate change, looking at the alpine communities. And we were, a whole group of us were up in June, and everything seemed fine with the alpine flowers and all. But we got a notice that dandelions had been invading one of our snowbed communities, one of the most diverse communities up there with many rare plants in it. So yesterday we had a trip starting at 5 in the morning and ending at 10 at night up to Mount Washington to see what was going on. And we did find this area, and it turned out there were 3 snowbeds invaded by dandelions, one with huge 12-inch roots and 25 branches, immense happy dandelions, but crowding out the plants that belong there.
Yeah.
And it was a gorgeous day, I have to admit. I was up there just in a sweater instead of in my down jacket and mittens, and as I was in June. And we need to get permits to take them out because, believe it or not, dandelions are not considered an invasive species in New Hampshire. They are, however, in Denali, where they're also having trouble with dandelions, even in the wilderness area. And there, the national park people are digging them out. So I think we'll succeed in doing this.
So why the sudden growth of dandelions? Is it indicative of a soil problem, something that's missing, or something that there's too much of?
Well, some people think that climate change is already happening, but the winds and cold in Mount Washington makes us think this is probably not happening to any large degree as yet, although we're expecting it to. But there are dandelions by the visitor center at the top and at some of the huts, and, you know, they blow around the seeds in the wind, and I think they just found themselves a wonderful spot. I did take a soil sample. The ones that are along the road are wimpy, not like these, but these have found a good home, and they're crowding out already these other species.
All right, so you will get the necessary permits and remove them?
We hope so.
Okay, and you'll have an update for us next time you are on. This is the Science Forum, and as I mentioned, you can email voxpop@wamc.org. And guess what, panel? We already have an email question. Actually came in well before the show started, so we'll ask it first. This is from Paul. Does the weight of the Earth remain constant, excluding evaporation, or is it constantly gaining or losing? Consider the following: growing and decay of living things, blasting rockets into space, population growth. Thank you for your answer. That's from Paul. Don't all jump at once.
Well, I can't imagine it's changing very, very noticeably, because if we have population growth, the population is absorbing materials that are already there and converting them to other forms. But we're still dealing with the same molecules. We are getting asteroids and other impacts from space, but I don't know that these are going to make that much of a difference.
Well, my recollection is that Ed Stander actually indicated that the asteroids were adding slightly to the weight of the Earth. I think the other factors are really too small to be detectable.
Are more asteroids coming than came before? Is that really a fact?
I don't know how we would know, because
there certainly are evidence of other asteroids having appeared even within time when there were people here.
Oh, yeah. But you'd have to have observers and ways of, essentially.
From other planets, maybe.
Quantifying. Okay.
I think he's talking about the smaller ones that are constantly bombarding the Earth.
Yeah.
I mean, the big ones also, but those are less.
They certainly are heavy, but I think it's not something new. You pick up an asteroid, meteorite, whatever, and it's heavier than you would have thought.
All right. Well, Paul, thank you for that email question. Let's go to the phones at 1-800-348-2551. Adrian in New Paltz, you're first.
Hey, Ray, welcome back from vacay.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Yeah, this is your trombone buddy.
All right.
Let's ask the brilliant people what F as Frank, E as Edgar, SS stands for. Maybe I can stump the panel.
Okay, FESS is what we're talking about?
Yes.
All right. Well, I was...
Okay, time's up.
All right.
So tell us.
Flywheel Energy Storage Systems. I used to attend some of these old-fashioned tractor shows. I was always intrigued by the flywheel engines. And flywheels have come a long way. It's one of the oldest tools that man has ever invented. Nowadays, they spin at huge rates. They store energy better than batteries. And I actually had a provisional patent, it has expired, but I want to put a flywheel inside an electric vehicle. And long story short, I think I can reduce the amount of weight that the batteries are heavy, so flywheels actually could weigh less. Anybody got anything on the radar as to bearings? The bearings are the key. They are experimenting with different gases like helium-charged bearings. They're also looking into magnetic levitation bearings. These flywheels are big, they're heavy, they're massive. They spin at a huge high 15 to 50,000 RPM. And right now the technology is such that they have to, as one of my professor friends says, you solve the bearing issue and you conquer the world.
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, good luck.
Anybody want to weigh in on the whole flywheel controversy?
We're all looking at each other. I think we're more biological.
Steventown, New York. It's up by you. The world's biggest flywheel energy storage system facility is operated by Beacon Power in Massachusetts, but who knows why it's located in Steventown, New York. And they've had a couple of accidents, but nobody was hurt.
Oh, no.
But anyway, it's an issue that I'm looking into. I'm
cool.
I just wonder whether any of your science folks...
I'll take it as homework.
All right, so Helen's going to look into that. And Adrian, great call. Thanks for getting us started here. John in Amherst. John, you're on.
Okay, my question is, lately my wife and I have been sitting outside at the end of the day and watching the sunset. And during the transition, we've been watching the bats flying over our house. And where we sit, we have a really good view because of the contrast of the sky. So my question is, I actually have two small ones regarding bat behavior. One is, if bats see by echolocation, I've noticed that bats that pursue other bats in the sky, the bat in front, the bat in lead, actually can tell somebody's coming up from behind him. So one of my questions is, can bats reverse echolocation? And the second thing is, in the 20 or 30 nights that I've been watching the bats, they spend 90% of their time making left turns.
Wow.
So that's something I was wondering if it was unique or it was typical.
All right, let's start with the bidirectional echolocation. Anybody?
Well, I have a question to clarify it a bit. What's your behavioral evidence that the front bat hears the, or is aware of the bat that's behind it?
Because the bat that's in front, if it's flying by itself, and say a bat comes from outside, from the woods into its area, it will sort of make a beeline for the bat. The bat may be looking forward, and as the bat behind closes in on the lead bat, the lead bat will, for lack of a better term, jink away up, down, left, right, loop, or whatever, and they'll break away, and then the pursuit will start again, and the same behavior until they disappear, and then one or two will come back in a different way.
I'd like to say that I'm really glad you're watching bats, because we've had a great deal of difficulty with bats in the last several years, and the bats populations, especially of little brown bats, which we used to have at Lake We Are all the time, are almost gone. So that's a good sign. But I think both the front and the back bed bat were echolocating and could therefore tell where the other one was.
Okay. So there's no stealth mode from a bat following another bat.
I wouldn't think that would be a problem.
They're extremely sensitive to frequency. Because that's
so the front bat would typically maybe pick up on the echolocation of the bat behind it, is what you're saying.
Well, not only that, go ahead. Nate. It may be getting information about how fast it's closing, for example, because of the way the cry changes
Doppler.
In frequency.
Hmm.
Because you've got two separate issues. One of them is finding stuff that's off in the distance. And for that, you're more likely to be using long wave calls. But then as you get closer to something, you want to see it, quote unquote, in more minute details. And so the frequency of the call has to be higher because if you have a very long wavelength, you're going to lose details in the middle of a particular wave, within a wave. So the calls are usually, we have constant frequency bats too, but that's another story.
Huh.
But they do frequency, most of ours are going to frequency modulate. And that means that if somebody's closing in on you, the frequencies are going to sound higher than they actually are because they're being compressed.
John, I tell you what, this is fascinating, and I know you have part two. If you could hang on, I'd like to find out about the bats that turn left and whether they put their blinkers on. It's the Science Forum on Vox Pop, and we'll be back.
Support for WAMC comes from the Nature Conservancy's Adirondack Chapter, working to preserve freshwater resources that flow from the Adirondacks to New York's urban centers. nature.org/Adirondacks. Sheehy Opticians, Albany, New York, providing eyeglasses, contact lenses, and eye exams since 1953. SHEEHYOpticians.com. College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair services and 24-hour towing and recovery service for over 30 years. CollegeStreetMotors.com. Miss Hall School, a boarding and day school for girls in grades 9 through 12, now accepting applications for September 2014. What girls have in mind, MissHalls.org. And Spectrum 8 Theaters, Albany, New York, showing Hollywood, American, independent, and foreign films, and presenting London's National Theater Series in HD and digital sound. Open daily, Spectrum8.com.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. It's the Science Forum, and we're talking with John from Amherst about bats. And before we get to your second portion of the question, John, if you're still with us, let's go back to how bats who are in a dogfight, as it were, up in the air, how one in the lead can be aware of the one in the back. And Helen just gave an interesting idea of what may be going on. My question is, how does the bat in front differentiate its echolocation signal with the signal of another bat? Doesn't that get confusing?
I would imagine it doesn't, because they're not phased in the same way. In other words, I send out a call now, and, 15 milliseconds later, you send out a call, but they're out of phase.
Mm. And also, they're often a great many bats together. I mean, I've seen thousands of bats in the sky. They're all looking for bugs and whatever, and they don't get confused with other bats chasing prey.
That's a lot of signals. So, and you talk about phasing. You'd think that there would be some sort of stealth effect where some cancel each other out, and then a bat is flying blind.
But for how long? In other words, the situation is changing radically, and we do the same thing visually. We have very complicated visual fields, but we don't.
But I'm not sending out rays out of my eyes.
Well, actually, I...
Am I?
I?
Yes,
guess
I
you
am.
Not, now that
you
I
are.
Heard you.
All right, let's go to the...
No, wait, okay, we had another comment.
Go ahead, Helmut.
I just want to look at a slightly different approach to it. If I remember my bat anatomy, the ears are they're facing forwards, if you will, to catch as much of the sound as possible. I'm assuming that when you're out there looking for something to eat, you want to have maximum sensitivity. As you get further behind the animal, I am speculating that some of that sound intensity is cut off. So the pursuing bat has to get a bit closer than he would if he were something to eat, and that maybe there's simply a difference in sound intensity in the two ears, and that could be a sufficient cue to tell the bat, hey, someone's coming close, I better swing around, because he did say they swing around in such a way as to presumably be able to confront the intruder.
And another thing is you can get some idea of the size of whoever it is by how it changes in direction. In other words, if it's very small, it's going to sound like it's coming from the same place, even if it's wobbling. But if it's large, you'll be able to tell more easily.
So it wobbles. In other words, is it modulated? Is it a modulated signal?
Well, I'm thinking just that the bats are both flying, which means that there's a certain amount of up and down and sideways. But it's like anything else. You can tell footsteps approaching, and you can get an idea sometimes of how large whatever it is by how much variation there is from side to side, from ear to ear.
And there's been a long time for bat evolution, and all kinds of fascinating things are done by bats. I watched a fish-eating bat in Panama once, and it was so fast you could almost not see it with your eyes. I mean, how it swooped down, got this fish, and went off.
Wow.
And it was not something a human could imagine doing.
All right, John, now we've talked quite a bit about this question. Now, the question of the 85% of the bats who take left turns, I must know more. Go ahead.
Well, normally what happens is when a bat comes into our area, we're able to look towards the western sky, so it's a real nice contrast. And you can see a bat will enter the area, and they 90% of the time, almost 100% of the time, start their circuit around over our yard, and they're making left turns. And then if they have a mosquito that or whatever, a bug that they attack or whatever, and it throws them out of the circuit, they might do right turns for a little bit. But for the most part, if you count, you know, let's say 300 circuits, out of the 300 circuits, about 260, 275 of them are to the left and not to the right. So I just, and I see that time and time again, and there's a couple of different sizes of bats, so I can differentiate at least that it's not the same bat doing it all the time.
Are these solitary? Are they flying alone, or are they in groups?
No, they're not in groups. We never have had more than one or two bats over our yard at a time. This year we've had three maybe at once, but when there's three at once, it seems like two of them will say, okay, there's enough going on here. We're going to go somewhere else for a while. So it's generally just solitary, not groups.
I would be curious as to whether they're going to the left in the southern hemisphere. No, we're all looking at each other, but there may be some kind of a...
I've certainly seen them going in both directions. What kind of bats are they, do you know?
I have no idea. I can't...
Communist. They lean left, right?
they're left-leaning bats.
There you go. They read the Nation. It's all good.
Can I just ask another question again to clarify? Are the bats generally coming to your place from pretty much the same generation? And you said they tend to circle around your house or your area.
Right.
And if they're coming in from the same direction, they may well just simply be circling. And they're coming in from somewhere they know, there's the house, and they start to make an approach. Mm-hmm. And it may simply be a coincidence that has nothing to do with a bat. But just having said that, we're finding out more and more animals that have what's known as lateralization. In other words, they prefer to use their right hand or their right leg or what have you. And so it's also quite possible that lateralization is very intense in bats. And I'm just going to throw something out. It's totally crazy, but I'll throw it out anyway. And that is that in humans, the degree of lateralization is affected by language. And perhaps bats have a much more elaborate auditory system that tends to increase the probability of going in one direction over another. But that's just a total guess.
Actually, I've heard about lateralization in other animals. Merdine Anderson at Yale actually studied reindeer in Lapland and found out that they all moved, I think it was counterclockwise rather than clockwise. But I don't think, although that question was discussed at some length, I think they never figured it out.
Well, one other last comment, since It could also be environmental. There might be prevailing wind patterns locally, just the way the wind is swirling above the property that is giving them some kind of a cue that they're just following.
Could magnetic fields be involved, as in bird navigation?
This is very short length, so I would be surprised.
Okay. Well, John, that was great. Thank you very much. We appreciate the call. Let's go to Lynn in Shelburne Falls. Whoops. Hi, Lynn. You're on.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
While I was waiting, I actually was sitting here and looking in my garden, my perennial garden, which I let the milkweed grow in. It's ugly, but it smells nice. And I know the monarchs eat it. So I noticed this little pile of something under the leaf, and it was a bunch of little quarter-inch worms. And I wondered if monarchs lay their eggs in a bunch.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, the monarchs actually don't eat the milkweed, but they do lay their eggs on the milkweed.
Oh, I thought they baby
so those are the
too.
Baby... Those are the little caterpillars. And interesting that they're still having another brood now. The monarchs tend to use nectar in various kinds of plants. I had one on my cup plant the other day. So I think what you're seeing is the baby caterpillars eating.
Okay,
on
so it can be on groups then. It's like, I don't know, 50, 20,
a bunch
75 of
eggs.
Them in one little group.
Yeah, the whole, they lay a bunch
things,
of eggs.
About a quarter inch long.
Okay. And...
My
anything
other question was, the first question I was going to ask was about the poles changing. I've heard about poles changing every million years or something, and what is that about? I don't understand, and how long does it take? And
you mean the magnetic poles?
Right. Yes.
9 years sounds awfully short. I don't have...
I think she said million.
Oh, million. I'm sorry. Yes, it did sound awfully short. Helmut, you look...
They do change, but I don't know what causes them. Do you?
I don't either, again, Ed Standard explained it, and that shows how little we remember.
Well, it's a tribute to Ed. You know, Lynn, we've talked about this. Bob Berman and I have talked about this quite a bit on the astronomy show. And from what I remember, scientists aren't quite sure. In other words, there isn't enough data to say, well, it's changing, how fast it'll change, how slowly it'll change. It's moving at something like 30 miles a year at this point.
Yeah, and what the effects are as it goes along.
Well, as Bob points out, there have been no, according to Bob, no mass extinction events tied to the record of magnetic pole shift. So I wouldn't sweat it, really.
I was just curious.
Except that...
so much. Bye now.
Bye, Lynn. Go ahead, Helmut.
Well, birds do use magnetic fields in navigating or in migrating.
Yeah.
And so a shift might in time, but they would also probably adapt to it.
So in other words, as if it was a quick shift, the birds might be a little discombobulated in their
right,
flights.
Yeah.
Okay. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. 1-800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Let's go to Charles in Huntington, Mass. Charles, you're on.
Well, an intriguing program. Always wonderful listening to Bright Minds. I have a question for the panel.
Oh, boy.
Because I just learned this reading, just learned this recently, reading a book entitled The Man Who Made Lists. Now, my question to the smart colleagues are, do they know who invented the slide rule?
All right, the slide rule, people. Yes?
Well, I bet my husband, the physicist, would know.
Would you like a lifeline?
I can do that for homework.
Okay.
All right. Well, the interesting thing is, it's always intriguing on the minds of the work. Peter Mark Roget was born in England back in 1779.
Yeah.
Later in his long life, being a medical doctor, making lists, he, of course, wrote Roget's Thesaurus, which in Latin means treasure, his treasured words.
All right.
He also invented the slide rule. That's a fascinating mind.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're dumbfounded, as a matter of fact. That's great.
And I know when my dad was an engineer, I had that K&E slide rule and trig. My brother in Princeton in the mid-60s, the professor, I think my dad gave them an early TI calculator, but the professor would not allow them to use it because he wanted them to learn the process of arriving at a solution. And that's a time frame. But I just thought it was fascinating on a man who created and published the thesaurus would invent the slide rule.
It is indeed.
Appreciated. Thank you.
One quick comment. If I remember my slide rules accurately, they make use of log scales, and I'm wondering if, in some sense, I can imagine somebody fooling around with a bunch of pieces of paper with log scales on them and suddenly realizing, oh, I can use this to make do arithmetic, to multiply and so forth.
Huh.
Yeah. And a real quick note, because I have this farm, and on the brook is what you think is a bridge embankment, but it's really where the sluice was for the up and down pitsaw that was throughout New England. That's how boards were cut. But it was in 1803 that a woman changed home construction forever. She was named as Tabitha Babbitt. I just learned this.
Oh.
And she was a Shaker based on her spinning wheel, which is always efficient. A saw is half wasted energy. Cut back, cut back. She invented the first circular saw.
Wow.
Okay.
That's great. Charles.
Well, the Shakers did a lot of
it. I mean, I'm fascinated. I'm just passing that on. It gives me an enormous crooked smile. And I learned on the sawmills that use the big 60, 58-inch saws, they're not flat. They're actually cupped. So when they were building up momentum, centrifugal force would straighten out that saw and hold it to a straight edge.
Wow.
How's that? And that's enough, but it fascinated me, and it's always a pleasure to hear smart minds work and talk, and I just wanted to pass that on.
Hey, Charles, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it very much. I got to say, panel, we've had an interesting program thus far.
I've learned more than anybody in the audience.
We've had bats. Yeah. We've had circular saws. We've had a thesaurus, a slide rule. It's fascinating.
My husband wandered around RPI when he was a professor with a slide rule, and some of the engineering students didn't know what it was.
Do you even need them anymore in these days of calculators and computers and anything else?
Well, we don't use them, whether we need them.
Actually, one of the things about slide rules is you can figure out what we call order of magnitude. Mm. And so that you can see, is my calculation make sense? And when you have an electronic calculator or a computer, you type something in, you make a little mistake, get out a bunch of numbers that say this is a significant finding, and you publish it. And in fact, you don't have any sense for the magnitude of the effect that you're looking for. So slide rules
gives you a visual.
They're teaching tools, if but people would kind of pay attention to them.
Number to call is 1-800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum, a very varied program today. Helmut Hirsch is here, Nancy Slack, and Helen Giardella. Yours truly, Ray Graff. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us. We'd be happy to hear from you in that fashion. voxpop@wamc.org. You can go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. We've got a Vox Pop post there. You could tweet us at @WAMC Vox Pop. You can go to our website, WAMC.org/VoxPop, and there's a spot to comment there. But we do love your phone calls, 1-800-348-2551. I'm still getting back to something you said about the bats and how they navigated and the wavelengths they use. I still don't understand, Helen, how they can differentiate, if there's a group of them, how they can differentiate between their signal and somebody else's signal. Is there some sort of encoding, like in the radio, in ham radio, you'd have a digital code on top of the signal, which would differentiate, this is my transmitter. How would a bat do that?
Well, I'm going to give a very unscientific answer. But as we are sitting here talking, I have no trouble differentiating my voice from yours, from Helmut's, from Nancy's. In other words, there are characteristic tones, wavelengths that we all produce. And there's no reason to suppose that that kind of variety doesn't exist in other organisms. You can tell your own dog's bark from anybody else's.
Yeah. Each of those mother penguins can tell its call of its baby apart from all the other thousands of babies.
So they have self-awareness, then. There's a level of intelligence that that perhaps we're not giving them credit for.
We humans rarely give credit where it's due. I think that's a political statement. But
you know, it's really interesting to have this talk about bats, because I went to a whole symposium about bats in Massachusetts in the spring, every single talk was about how all the bats were disappearing and what they could do about it, and how there used to be 1,000 and now there's 28. And so it's good to know they're out there flying around.
True enough. Let's take a break here, Kimbo. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Back to your calls in a moment. It's the Science Forum.
Support for WAMC comes from the Preservation League of New York State, Albany, New York, protecting New York's historic buildings, districts, and landscapes since 1974. PreserveNYS.org. Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, Quarry and Fabrication, used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking. Rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires, AshfieldStone.com. Lori Stillwell, CPA, PC, providing tax and accounting services for businesses and their owners in Saratoga Springs and beyond. StillwellCPA.com. The Department of Theater Arts at SUNY New Paltz, an undergraduate theater program in liberal arts with concentrations in design and technology, theater studies and performance, newpaltz.edu/theatre. And Snow Farm, the New England craft program. August workshops include woodworking, glassblowing, batik, watercolors, and more. Space available in weekend or week-long classes in Williamsburg, Massachusetts, snowfarm.org.
Vox Pop on WAMC, The Science Forum, Helmut Hirsch, Nancy Slack, Helen Giardella, and yours truly, Ray Graff. You at home on the phone. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. We go to Phil in Northville, New York. Hi, Phil, you're up.
Hey, how are you guys doing this afternoon? Great show. I just had the call in regarding the fellow's earlier call about magnetic polarities changing. I'm reading for the fourth time a fascinating book by Bill Bryson called A Short History of Nearly Everything, kind of like Science for Dummies, but just got done reading a thing about the magnetic field, and it changes about every, I believe, it's 600,000 years is what they estimated at, and they're able to estimate that basically by looking at the ferrous iron in the earth, how to crystallize when it gets formed, how it crystallizes, so they're able to go back and look. We're a little bit overdue for it right now. One of the negative effects of it is as it gets set to do a massive shift, the magnetic field actually lowers down quite a bit, which kind of provides us with a shield for cosmic radiation. And they've estimated that it's gone down by about 6% in the last 100 years, if my memory serves me correct. But
I think
so
that's
there are
close,
other effects that come from it. But excellent book for reading, and I just wanted to pass that on to you guys.
Thank you very much.
600,000 years is the number.
Okay, Phil, thanks a lot. And again, though, even if the magnetic field lowers quite a bit, the record doesn't show a lot of species dying off because of that. So we should have enough protection.
Well, but we'd have to know then that fossilized birds or whatever migrated and used magnetic fields as one of their components.
Yeah, or dinosaurs.
Well, okay.
It's sometime in the
anything,
past.
Actually.
Anything that migrates and uses magnetic fields. And there's plenty of evidence in more and more organisms for cells that are sensitive to magnetic fields. So a sudden shift could have lots of unexpected effects.
All right. Well, let's go back to the phones. John in Hudson. John, you're on.
Hello.
Hello. You're on.
Earlier, you had a discussion on whether or not the Earth is getting lighter, heavier, what have you. Has anybody estimated the amount of fuel or oil taken out of the ground? It's not only just gas. In 1973, they said that we were burning 183 million gallons of gas a day. But you have fuel oil for home heating oil. You have oil products that are used in plastics.
We get your point. Panel, what do you think?
Pardon me?
I'm asking the panel here what they think.
Oh.
Well, if they take it out of shale rocks, the shale rocks are still there. I don't know. It really changes the weight all that much.
Well, the oil is still there. In other words, whether it's above ground or below ground.
We're using the oil.
It's changing form, but it's still with us. It's not escaping the Earth's gravitational field.
Except for nuclear reactions, mass is conserved, And so it just takes a very different form. Now, if more of it blows off into space because it's high in the atmosphere, that might make a difference. But I kind of doubt that those molecules are light enough to wind up all the way at the top. So my guess is that wouldn't produce any changes in total weight of the Earth. It may cause changes in the soil, in the land where you've been drilling for it.
And it may seem like a lot, but compared to the total weight of the planet, it really is not.
And you think if it was really a big change, you'd see it in the orbits of the planets.
Right.
But yeah. we haven't. So.
All right, here's
the orbit of the moon.
Or the moon. Okay.
Here's one via email from Jim in Delmar. Once a canister of tear gas has exploded, can you walk us through how that gas dissipates in the air, what traces are left behind in the environment, etc.? So tear gas exploding, how does it dissipate? What traces are left behind? Panel.
Well, my only experience with tear gas was as a graduate student, and I know what it feels like, but, all I did was run, so
okay,
I didn't
right.
gather a lot of data on the way.
People deteriorate.
But, yeah. All right, well, in general, maybe we can not use tear gas, but explain the process of the gas dissipating in the air and what traces are left behind.
I think this is going to vary very much on the situation. Molecules of gas are going to diffuse. They're going to spread. They're going to gradually take up more volume, which means that the density is going to be less. But other than that...
This has been a strange show, hasn't it?
Well,
very odd.
When you're talking about dispersal... is this independent of someone being tear gassed? Because if you exposed to tear gas, something remains in your eyes and probably in other parts of your body that takes a while to go away. But if you're talking just about the dissipation in air, I think what Professor Girardella said would be the answer.
But I don't think any of us actually know the chemical composition of tear gas, so... I don't think we can really answer your question.
This is not the panel that...
All right. We'll have a tear gas fox pop at some point. Okay. Matthew in Holyoke. Matthew, you're on.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon. I'm curious as to why scientists don't seem to be as concerned about the overuse of phosphorus and the depletion of phosphorus in the stockpiles in the Earth. I mean, that's going to be a greater impact on society and the world in the much nearer future than global warming. And yet very few people seem to be concerned about the overuse of phosphorus and the depletion of it as an element that we can constantly mine, which is not going to happen.
Well, the overuse of phosphorus, I'm not quite sure in what connection you're asking the question, but we've been quite worried about phosphorus getting into lakes by the overuse of fertilizers and really changing nutrient cycles in lakes, affecting all the organisms that the fish feed on and the fish themselves.
Right. I understand that, but my question is, I mean, once phosphorus has been used in, like, fertilizers and gets into the environment, it's not something that can be reclaimed.
Well, a lot of it is recycled. It's recycled in lakes, for example, gets to the bottom and comes up, and when the lake turns over in the spring and the fall and is reused by the organisms there, so it hasn't just disappeared from the world.
But I'm interpreting your question a little bit differently, which is that phosphorus is one of many chemicals or materials that we use a lot of, and there's always a question: what happens when the supply of phosphorus gets low, so that there's still some left, but now you begin to wonder how we're going to afford it and how we're going to pay for it. I think it's a general question about resource depletion, and
right.
I can only say that I don't understand either why that's not something that concerns more people.
Right, because I know Dr. Elser out of Tempe, Arizona, is studying that, and that's going to be one of the major problems with our society, is that we're not going to have the phosphorus to, you know, mine and use on an everyday basis like we are now. And so then that source is depleted, and then where do you actually get it from after that?
Well, thank you, Matthew. Appreciate
I see that could be a problem. Right now, we're really worried about the depletion of water, especially by overuse, especially in the West.
Yeah.
I was just out there experiencing this.
Let's go over to Marjorie in Saugerties. Hello, Marjorie.
Hello, hello. How are you?
Good. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. Nice to be here. I have a question that I've been meaning to ask for a really long time, and that is, why does food in, that is heated in a microwave cool faster than food that is heated in an oven?
All right. Panel?
I would assume it's because of the uneven heating. That is, the microwave doesn't heat everything uniformly when you stick, I don't know what, into an oven. It generally reaches a constant temperature throughout the substance that you have in your oven. And so because it's all at that oven temperature, it's going to take more time for it to cool down. With the food in the microwave, parts of it, if you notice, are still too cool, while others are kind of warm. And so there is less overall heat stored in microwave food.
But I do think if you heat the same thing, same kind of food in the oven in the microwave, and test the temperature when you take it out, it'll take the same amount of time to cool. I think you're right, though.
You think that that's true? I'm going to try that experiment. I've never tried that, but I always notice that when I warm something in a microwave, it really cools off quickly. When I warm something or make something in an oven, it takes a while.
I wonder if you take it out and stir it halfway through and then put it back in and make sure it's uniformly heated, if you'll see the same results.
And if you take it out of the oven, do you leave it in the container that you used, baked it in, or whatever you did in the oven?
No, not usually. Okay. I mean, if I'm making a roast or something, I take it out and put it on a cutting board.
Well, try the experiment and tell us your results next time.
Yes.
I certainly will.
Thanks, Marjorie.
Will. Thank you, Ray.
Talk to you soon. Let's go on over to Chaz in Clifton Park. You're on.
Yeah, hi. First of all, I'd like to say I'm really glad this show's back. I missed it.
Oh, well, it's not every month, usually.
Well, I think it was up the air for a while.
Okay.
But anyway, this is a pretty simple question, I think. I walk my dog at night, and on a hot summer night, I have a headlamp on my head so I can see in the dark. And on certain nights, I assume it's humid nights, I can see my breath like you can in the winter. That struck me as odd. I didn't know you could see your breath in the summer.
Okay, so even though it's warm out.
Yeah.
I'm going to take a stab at it. When you breathe out, the air you breathe out is fairly moist. And I'm just guessing, especially when you've got one of these headlamps on, which have a pretty intense light, that you are able to see the difference in moisture content for just a moment between your breath and everything else out there. That's the only thing I could imagine is what's going on.
Really, I thought I was the only one who didn't know this, or didn't know this wasn't a phenomenon or something.
Anybody else want to weigh in?
Well, we're all looking at each other and trying to think of...
We can go home and put our headlamps on and see if this happens.
Yeah.
I think it would depend on what kind of night you're out on as well, you know, what the humidity was and such.
Okay. Chaz, great observation and a great question, and we appreciate it. Let's go to Sandy in Charlemont.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a botany question.
Okay.
Driving on a road through the woods in the Berkshires, I came across a site in the spring I'd never seen before, and taking walks in woods in a grove, a beautiful grove, and what looked to be maybe a vernal pond. In the springtime, hundreds of stems with a ball at the top, kind of a dark reddish. And when the sun shone through, it was magnificent. They were all magnificently aglow. And so I would take more trips up through this patch up there. And I looked it up. I couldn't find anything. And when it opened up, it seemed they were orchids. And, you know, in my time going in the woods, I had never found a grove or seen a grove like this before. And I'm just wondering, I couldn't find too much information on it. If anybody on the panel can help me out with some information on this.
They were flowers that opened out from these balls?
Yes.
And,
yep.
And what color were they?
Variegated, light. The petals were light, one flower on each stem.
And how many petals?
Oh, I'm not sure
didn't
anymore.
Look, are they really tall or short?
Yes, very tall. It looked like there were no leaves at all. They just looked like they were on sticks almost, in a little open area in the woods.
Wow. Where was this?
But there were leaves. When I looked closer, a couple leaves in the bottom, and when I opened it up, when they opened up, it looked like some sort of orchid to me.
Yeah, I don't think it was an orchid. Maybe a lily? No. Could it have been a lily?
Oh.
Where was this, Sandy?
The Berkshire woods in Massachusetts.
You didn't take a picture, did you?
I didn't. I did not. Didn't have anything.
Well,
with
there aren't any really tall orchids that grow outdoors in the East, so I don't think it was an orchid, but it's hard to tell from your description what it could be. Anybody else have any thoughts?
No.
Well, the ball itself was red, but the flower that opened up was light with a stripe in it.
Wow.
I think a cream color maybe with some.
Perhaps you have stumped the band here.
Anybody has a good idea, call in and let us know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks, Sandy. We appreciate the call.
Thank you.
1-800-348-2551. James in Hudson. James, you're on.
Okay. Yes, the lady that called just recently, about two phone calls ago, talked about heating in the microwave versus heating in a stove or on an oven or on a stove. And I think she's exactly right, because things do not keep their heat the same way. And I know it's about I'm not being a show off here, but molecules moving more rapidly, but they don't move as rapidly otherwise is when you put them in the oven or on a stove, because things just cool down. Like when I make milk for coffee, and I have lived places where I have a microwave and I don't have a microwave. And when I heat up milk for coffee, it cools down much faster when I use the microwave than when I do it on top of the stove.
Scientists, if something reaches a certain temperature, the molecules are moving at the same speed regardless of how it's heated, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So it doesn't make sense to me.
It doesn't to me either.
Well, how
it
are
doesn't
you
make sense either, but I have to say I've done this for, this is years and years of, going my parents' house, going to my house, or, whatever. And I always notice there's a difference.
Well, I'll do that experiment with my coffee tomorrow. Okay.
But I think Helmut did nail it, depending, how are you assessing
it? It really shouldn't make sense, because I know it's just molecules moving more quickly.
I think you'd have to use a thermometer.
I have a suggestion for you for a simple experiment. Heat up whatever milk or whatever you're doing both ways, and then take a small straw and try to immediately when you take it out of the microwave, take a little sip near the outside, a little sip near the middle.
Exactly.
A little sip maybe down lower or something. So get a sense, and you'll have to work kind of quickly.
Make things heat from the inside out, whereas heat from the outside in. It's not that it doesn't reach the same temperature. It's just that it cools off more quickly.
Have you ever
I don't understand.
Have you ever heated milk conventionally? Have you only heated milk in a microwave? Maybe it's the...
No, I'm heated conventionally too, and it stays hotter longer. That's the thing. That's the difference. It's not that it doesn't reach the same temperature.
Huh.
It's that it cools off quicker, which I don't understand. Yeah.
What I don't understand is how we've talked half a show about, about this.
It's
amazing.
One of the things that keeps me, my mind.
If anybody's going after...
I'm going to hang up and listen to the rest of the show.
And that's a question with an answer. Maybe we can find it.
If anybody is going after this, please do not use a microwave, a thermometer that's mercury.
In the microwave.
Yeah, especially. But don't use an old-fashioned mercury thermometer, please.
True. Okay, well, on that bizarre note, I guess we're going to have to wrap up the show. Helen Giardella, thank you for being here. Interesting, yeah? You're coming?
Fantastic.
Will you ever come back?
If you invite me.
All right, you'll be invited back then. Nancy Slack, thank you. When are you heading back up to the mountain?
Oh, maybe not till early in the spring.
Operation
when
Dandelion.
When all the dandelions are out, we can see them.
Okay, you can make some tea.
Well,
right?
Look out for those other plants while you're there.
And Helmut Hirsch, thank you very much. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
And everyone who listened, boy, great, great, Great questions for the most part. Support comes from Kent Hicks Construction, West Chesterfield, Massachusetts, specializing in energy-efficient, net-zero, passive house home building, deep energy retrofits, and historical restorations, serving Western Massachusetts. KentHicksConstruction.com. Quality Foreign Car Care, Ballston Spa, New York, specializing in European car sales and service for over 20 years. QFCC.com. Berkshire Museum, Pittsfield, Massachusetts, butterflies on view with a live butterfly pavilion with exotic and native butterfly species, activities for adults and children, berkshiremuseum.org, and Double H Ranch, Lake Luzerne, New York, providing outdoor Adirondack adventures for children with chronic and life-threatening illnesses, a serious fun camp, doublehranch.org. Thanks again for being here. Thanks to our engineer, Kimba Lipscomb, Lipscomb. Yeah, Kimba. Let's call you Kimba. Thanks to Colleen O'Connell, who answered the calls, our producer, Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's travel on Vox Pop. Stay tuned now for a news update.